Blog Talk Radio.
How on the ball I am with random shit like that. To me, stuff like the date is random. I just live, bro. I just live. I have a lot of great stuff to talk to you guys about today. Right off the bat here, we're going to discuss money and politics. There's a great article in New York Magazine which details just how much the billionaires think they own the system. And, I mean, they think that because they're right. They do own the system the overwhelming majority of the time. Every once in a while you get lucky in the sense that big money doesn't come through. But obviously we function more like an oligarchy at this point. And when you see their sense of entitlement, oh my God, you're going to understand full well the mindset of somebody who doesn't view this as a nation that should have one man, one vote. To them, it's a nation that, you know, very simply should be theirs. They own it. And then as we move along, we have the climate change deal that was reached with all the world governments. And my take on it isn't as flowery and happy-go-lucky as you might expect. I mean, I was reading it expecting to be, like, you know, overjoyed and happy that, well, we're finally doing something serious to fight back against this scourge. But the details make it seem like it's a little bit of window dressing. Use a window shopper. That's what I was thinking in my head as I was reading the article. That's not related at all, but you get the point. Then more information about how ISIS is greatly helped by the former Ba'athist Party, that's Saddam Hussein's political party. So it's further evidence to solidify what most of you guys already know, which is that if it wasn't for us invading Iraq and destabilizing it, you certainly would not have ISIS be the gigantic powerhouse that it is today. They'd probably be broken down and fractured, and it'd be the same as Al-Qaeda in Iraq was. That was the former group. That's what it was called. So more information on that. And then, of course, I have some goofy pastors who give you hilarious arguments for creationism in the show, because why not? And then, what percentage of the American people are absolutely certain, that's a quote, absolutely certain that God exists? Man, I am going to fucking mock some people later today, let me tell you, because it's unacceptable. The percentage of people that are sure in America, and, you know, I should be totally clear here, the reality is, you go to other nations, I mean, only other modern nations would fare better than us, but, like, the lesser developed the nation, the more likely they are to overwhelmingly believe in God in an even stronger way than we do. So I'm going to be mocking us, but make no mistake about it, my mocking pretty much generalizes for the rest of the world, save maybe Europe and, you know, maybe Australia and a handful of other countries. So we'll talk about that and much more. So let's get started, and we'll kick it off, like I said, with this issue of money and politics, and I can give you some details from a great article today. New York Magazine has a superb article by Gabriel Sherman detailing the plight of the poor billionaire. And in fact, it details the plight of the billionaire oligarch who just can't seem to always buy our elections. So in their mind, of course, they give the tremendous amounts of money that they do. They think, well, I mean, it is my system. It is my country. Forget one man, one vote. Well, we know that it's not that simple. It's a little bit more complex than that. And they're mad that it's more complex than that. They would like it to be a total oligarchy. So he points out in the article the curious case of Karl Rove, who runs the super PAC, American Crossroads. Of course, the main goal of it is to try to get Republicans elected everywhere. And Rove, in the 2012 election, raised over $100 million trying to get Romney and trying to get others elected. And I think we all know how that ended up. That was an election where the Republicans got their clocks cleaned. So the billionaires that he relied on for the money for his group were so pissed that, quote, to many of the billionaires, it felt like a mugging. A few days after the election, New York hedge fund manager Daniel Loeb, who'd helped finance Rove's surge, tried to sue Crossroads and Fox News for misrepresenting the facts. Quote, Loeb felt this was like an investment bank committing fraud on a roadshow. After conferring with a securities lawyer, Loeb discovered that there are no investor protections in politics. Gee, you don't say. So he was so sure that he was going to win. When he didn't, he literally wanted to sue Fox News, wanted to sue Karl Rove, and wanted to sue all the political operatives that told him point-blank period, hey, you give us money, and we're going to win because we're going to flood the market with negative ads, and that's the way politics works in America. The people who raise the most money end up winning. And why does he have this sense of entitlement? This is an important part of the picture. Because he's used to winning. He's used to flooding campaigns with money, and then he's used to seeing, oh, look, my guy won, in large part because I gave them a tremendous amount of money, so they get their name out there more, and they get more people to vote for them. And to show you just how widespread the problem is, overall, 91% of the time, the better finance candidate ends up winning. So it works a little bit differently for the presidential election, because you get a lot of free press in the presidential election. But still, the person who raised the most money in 2012 did end up winning. Obama raised more money, and he ended up winning. So the thing is, he's mad that he was beaten at his own game. And understand, it's not like President Obama deserves a pat on the back for all this, because he was taking money from Wall Street, too. There's no doubt about it, which is why a lot of the reform was just window dressing. There are tremendous loopholes in Dodd-Frank, but he gets to say to the world, no, I did historic financial reform, even though when you get into the details, they're allowed to do a lot of the same things that led us into the financial mess in the first place. But now, here's the part of this puzzle that fits into today. They say that to quell fears about, because a lot of the billionaires are like, fuck, we got burned in 2012. We gave a lot of money and we didn't get anything out of it. And, you know, that's rare. Usually the billionaires give money and they get what the fuck they want. It's that simple. When the people get elected, they do their bidding. More like an oligarchy than a democracy. So now, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio saw the way the system works, and they're getting smart about it. They say, no, instead of you just giving me money and writing me blank checks, like, for example, Sheldon Adelson did for Newt Gingrich the last time around when he had his brief run and he had his moment in the sun where he was leading and beating Romney for a while. They say, how about instead of you just giving me money and then I get to spend it however I want, you guys can feel like it's more hands-on. So if you want to write me a check, you get to pick exactly what the campaign spends it on. You get to say, hey, I want this only spent in Iowa because I think Iowa is more important. It sets the tone for the rest of the places. Hey, I only want this spent in New Hampshire because New Hampshire is important strategically. Or, hey, I only want this spent on ads in this place because we're on the verge in this state, but I think we can be tipped over the edge if we flood that market with the money. So we went from a system that was a vague oligarchy. You take money from the millionaires and the billionaires and the corporations and the lobbyists, and then you spend it how you want. And then, you know, hopefully, to them, they win, and then they do their bidding. Now, it's like, okay, let's cut out a lot of the middlemen, the people who are the political operatives in the campaign who make the decisions, and just have the billionaire oligarchs come in and do everything for our campaign. Pick where they want to spend the money, how they want to spend the money. And the entire time, these smarmy bastards, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, go around the country and speak to the people like, to Ted Cruz, I'm going to use his voice because, of course, me, I think that I care about the American people and that the other candidates are not for the American people. and we gotta do what's good by them. And this Obama economy is disastrous, and the Democrats don't care about you. They want to raise your taxes. Me, I'm Ted Cruz. Me. In reality, he's got hands-on billionaire oligarchs running his shit. How gross is this system? There's no intellectual defense for this system. If somebody's going to defend this, they have to just tell you, yeah, no, I'm in favor of not having a democracy, not having one man, one vote. I'm in favor of big moneyed interests, spending for the political candidates, and then getting what they want when said candidate gets in office. And it's the Republicans and the Democrats that are guilty of this, too, guys. Remember that. The Democrats might have a few less scary special interests, like teachers, unions, and lawyers, but overall, they're taking Wall Street money, too, and they're representing Wall Street as well. So this is a problem in both political parties, and the billionaires are now so fucking entitled that they wanted to sue when their candidate didn't win the last time around. What an amazing broken system we have. Hey, to all the grassroots Republicans and conservatives out there who don't like this, I'll shake on it right now that we get all union money out of politics, all lawyer money out of politics, all teachers' money out of politics, and all the special interests that you guys hate. Let's shake on it. George Soros, forget about it. He's done. Al Gore, done. All these guys, done. As long as you say no more Koch brothers money, no more Sheldon Adelson money, no more Foster Freeze money, no more billionaire fossil fuel industry money, none of that stuff. Let's get rid of your special interests and your lobbyists and our special interests and our lobbyists and the ones that we share on Wall Street. Let's get rid of all that, publicly finance the campaigns, and then this way you have a real debate of ideas and of competing philosophies and concepts. As opposed to right now, it's just dueling donors. Donor can suck off the billionaire enough to get more money from the billionaire to flood the market with deceptive ads to then get elected based off of those deceptive ads, which people fall for. So there it is, man. We can end this if we fight for it and if we try, and it does require at this point a constitutional amendment. Wolfpack is working on it. Move to Amend is working on it. And the idea is we go through the states because Congress is too corrupt. They're not going to do it on their own. And then we get this amendment which says clean elections from here on out. It's that simple. So there's our answer. We know what our answer is. And I know that everybody across the spectrum who's an honest person wants to change a system where the billionaires are so entitled that if they don't win, in the tiny percentage of time they don't win, they want to sue because they didn't win, which means they're not going to get to buy all of the legislation in Congress. Okay. Now, let's keep it moving with the climate change big news of the day. Unfortunately, I will have to shit on it and make all you guys a little bit upset. But what are you going to do? Got to give the facts. World governments reached a climate change deal to limit the amount of warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius. So this is a big deal, for sure. A lot of different outlets are portraying this as the last-ditch effort for the world to get its shit together to fight against absolute catastrophe. I mean, I'm semi-convinced we're already at the point of absolute catastrophe, and everything we do now is just minor tweaks around the edges to prevent the worst of the worst of the worst of catastrophes. But nonetheless, let me give you the details, and then you guys can make up your own mind here. Science Alert reports, the agreement recognized two fundamental facts. First, that climate change represents an urgent and potentially irreversible threat to human societies and the planet, and thus requires the widest possible cooperation by all countries. And second, that deep reductions in global emissions will be required in order to achieve the ultimate objective of the convention and emphasizing the need for urgency in addressing climate change. So again, that's absolutely necessary and fantastic that the world governments are saying, okay, we're on board with it. We're recognizing it. We know we got to do something about it. So let's move forward. So what are the specifics of the deal? Well, the richest nations agreed to raise enough funds so that by the year 2020, $100 billion a year will be made available to developing nations to help them get off of dirty energy. So the way it works right now, the more advanced economies are obviously more reliant on fossil fuels, and we're, of course, hence bigger polluters. So those nations, a lot of people say, for them to develop, they need dirty energy, so they're going to be more reliant on that. And this is the first world nations, the rich nations, saying, well, how about we give them $100 billion a year for a while to make it so that, you know, it gets them off of dirty energy, and we can all invest in whatever, wind, solar, geothermal, and other green technology in order to move forward. Now, so that's, you know, that's a positive thing, and there are legitimate questions and concerns about that. How are you going to give them the money? How is it going to be implemented? Do you know the level, the extent of corruption in those governments? Now, I know it's hard for people in the U.S. to talk about, ooh, other governments are so corrupt. We're immensely corrupt. That's obvious. We rail about that every day. But nonetheless, it's still a valid question about other governments. It's not like, you know, they all have rainbows and puppies and there's no corruption there. Of course there is. There's corruption in all governments. So there are some legitimate question marks about that. But in principle, I think it's a good idea. It's just a matter of execution and how you carry it out. Now, the richest nations, they say other than that, the process by which you go about this is on each individual country. Quote, but the legal requirements that they publicly monitor, verify, and report what they are doing, as well as publicly put forth updated plans, are designed to create a name and shame system of global peer pressure in hopes that countries will not want to be seen as international laggards. So this is where a lot of experts are saying, that's a red flag, because the punishments or the incentive system that's set up is just, if you don't do it, we're going to go, we're going to shame you. That's pretty weak, in my opinion. That's pretty weak. I'm telling you, I read all these articles wanting to get super excited and wanting to say, all right, yes, we finally got our shit together. We're going to really combat climate change now. But what I got is, okay, some money for the developing nations to make sure that they get on green technology. Promises to not increase warming more than 2 degrees Celsius over time. And then this, which is, it's on each individual nation to determine how they do that. And if they don't do that, we go, oh, shame on you. Shame on you. You know, the thing that really sticks out in my mind as I read this is, we're kind of willy-nilly with the UN and with international law as it is today. And actually, to be fair, the U.S. is the worst with that. I mean, we just brazenly and wantonly violate international law whenever the fuck we want, because we say, in essence, we're above the law because, you know, we got the biggest military in the world, and say something. You know, whether it's doing torture or whether it's not paying reparations to governments who we fucked over in the past, then we technically owe them reparations. The list goes on and on. But in this case, I don't think it's just the U.S. that's probably not going to meet the goals, and then there's going to be nothing but shame on you. They're not going to care about that. But I think it's other nations too. You know, I mean, China, if they so choose to go in the direction of renewable energy, they can do it, and they can do it faster than the U.S. because they're a communist dictatorship where they can just say, boom, done, over, you know, no more dirty energy, and that's it. You know, nobody else in the country has a say. So it's a bad way for them to go about doing it because the CIS structure of their government is fucked up and worse. But point is, they could do it if they so choose, and do I think they're going to do it? No, I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think the U.S. is going to do it. I don't think a lot of the other modern nations are going to do it. And in all seriousness, the developing nations, even if you give them $100 billion, I'm not sure it's going to be spent in the right way. And, you know, it is true that those underdeveloped economies, at this point, it does make more sense for them, from a financial perspective, to get more involved with dirty energy. That's just the reality of the situation. I wish that wasn't true, but it is true. So my sense of this is that it's super vague and super weak, even though everybody's saying, well, at least we got something. And that part is true as well. I mean, at least we did get something, but let's keep it in perspective here. This is basically the Obamacare of climate change deals. And what I mean by that is, with Obamacare, the real answer to fix the U.S. healthcare system was Medicare for All, which is a single-payer system. And then if you weren't going to do that, at the very least, you should have done what's called a public option, which is a system you can buy into, a government system you can buy into if you so choose. But we didn't get any of that. We got the weakest reform, which is keep the private insurance companies intact, which are the heart of the problem, and the for-profit model intact, which is the heart of the problem, and then, tweak around the edges and help people that way. So again, Obamacare in the end was better than doing no reform, but it was the worst of all possible kinds of reforms. This strikes me as the same thing for climate change. It's better than not getting any deal between all the different nations around the world, but as far as the specifics of any deal go, it's not great because they just have vague promises of, we promise it won't get too bad, and hey, here's some money for the developing nations. But other than that, it's like, now nobody fuck up, because if you do, we're gonna shame you. Because, shame usually works so well on the world stage. Okay, now. I'm actually not sure I want to get into this foreign policy story yet, because I might need a wee bit more time. So, I'm going to skip ahead and do the story on the lack of justice in, what state was it again? Did I really not write down the state name? That's fucked up, man. All right, I guess I'm not doing that one because I got to look up the state name. How did I not do that? I'm such a putz. I haven't used that word in forever. I kind of like it. All right, never mind. I'll do the pot brownie story because I have enough time to laugh at people. Some elementary school teachers in Detroit got sick because they ate weed brownies that they found in the teacher's lounge. So Huffington Post reports, quote, Oakland County sheriff's officials said deputies were called to Spring Mills Elementary School on a tainted food complaint. A teacher became ill the day before and later tested positive for marijuana at a hospital. Police say two other teachers felt sick but didn't seek medical treatment. The deputies recovered the remaining brownies, and tests revealed that they contained THC. So I should be clear about this and say that they don't know if this was some kind of a prank or if it was a mistake, and somebody brought their brownies to school, but they didn't want to share them with everybody. They just wanted to have them themselves or with their buddies or whatever. But everybody thought they were sick when they ate them. So the people that ate them, not knowing they were weed brownies, were convinced that it was like food poisoning and they were sick. And again, none of them actually went to the hospital, but apparently a few of the teachers had said, "Hey, you feel weird last night?" "Yeah, I felt weird last night." And so they had called the police to come and, for whatever reason, check out the tainted food situation at the school. And that's when they figured out exactly what had happened. But there's actually a really important message to take away from this, which is that people need to understand they were duped. So again, that's a fact. Let's get that out there. But when you eat marijuana, when you eat weed, when you do an edible, it's not going to get you high in the same way that it would if you smoked a little weed. You actually get significantly higher if you eat weed. And I don't know all the details of it. I've read articles that explain why that is, but bottom line, the way that your body metabolizes it when you eat it, it has a stronger effect, and it actually functions as a mild psychedelic, if you will. Whereas if you smoke it, it's not nearly as powerful. So, and that's why, for example, I don't know if you guys remember when Maureen Dowd, the New York Times writer, decided to go to Colorado and test out weed, legal weed there. she wrote this scathing article about how it's bad and it's not good. And why is that? Because she bought edibles and she fucking housed an entire thing. And then she was beyond high. She was shot in a cannon to Neptune in her mind. And she's like, oh my God, I'm so scared. I'm so paranoid. This is horrible. This is horrific. I can't deal with this. Why would anybody do this drug? It's the worst drug ever. I hate everything. And then she wrote an article, you know, against weed, basically. And people were like, you jackass, you don't understand. First, most of the edibles, you should only take a bite, for example. Or if it's like certain kinds of candy, sometimes you just need one piece of candy, whether it's a gummy worm or whatever. Or some people need half of it or a quarter of it because it's going to get you really fucking high. So perhaps the answer is, again, this wouldn't affect this case that we're talking about here, but perhaps the answer is more clear labeling so as to educate people, where even seasoned weed smokers, if you eat, you know, a whole candy bar that has 100 milligrams, 200 milligrams, 300 milligrams, you're going to get beyond high and you are going to feel sick. And that happens a lot, where people ingest weed, they eat it, they don't know that they did it, and then they do end up going to the hospital and they're like, bro, what the fuck is happening? I think I'm dead and I'm watching my own body. And they say shit like that. No, you're okay, you're going to be all right, but let's not give marijuana a bad name because your dumbass accidentally ate it or ate too much of it or don't know the rules, don't know how it works, don't know what your dosing is, so on and so forth. Marijuana and other drugs, legalize them, tax them, regulate them, but also educate about them so that people know their limits and they know when they've gone way too far. Okay. Now, I'm going to take a break, and then when we come back, we'll get into 812 different things. How do you like that for a tease? All right, stay there.
I
back, y'all. Let's get into some serious stuff. So in 2014, a sleeping baby nearly died after an officer threw a stun grenade on his chest during a no-knock raid. So the room was empty, the officer barges in, throws a stun grenade, lands right in the crib on the 19-month-old baby's chest. Blew a hole in the chest. Now, somehow, the baby survived. I don't know how, but obviously there was a tremendous amount of damage, severe injuries, and it required a lot of hospital visits, a lot of surgeries in order to make it so that the baby survives. So civil rights charges were brought up against the officer, Nikki Autry, and we get the word today that she's not guilty on all charges. So, I mean, there should be other obvious things that should have been brought up as charges, whether it's whatever, some form of gross negligence in the sense that you don't know what's going on or who's in there, but you throw the stun grenade and nearly kills a baby. Or also just the fact that they were doing this no-knock raid because they had gotten a tip from somebody that the people in the house were selling amphetamine. They weren't selling amphetamine. Totally innocent. So think about that. That's like you. I'm sure you are not selling amphetamine. Could you imagine somebody barges into your house and throws a stun grenade on your kid's chest, nearly kills your kid, and you did nothing wrong. You're like, what the fuck is happening when they break down the door? And then you try to get some kind of recourse, whether it's through actual charges, which they didn't get, or some kind of civil rights charges because the family, I believe, was Indian and she was white. Nothing. Nothing stuck. Nothing stuck. So Bukam, or Boo Boo, as the baby's called, Fonisavan, is still recovering from the severe injuries, and his medical bills are close to $1 million. Of course, the parents are furious that, you know, nothing, they weren't able to get her on anything, this officer on anything, and she's ecstatic. So after the trial, she said, quote, I'm just happy everyone sees the truth. What truth? What truth? Because whether or not you meant to, you know, gravely damage the baby or not, the reality is, shouldn't you still face some kind of consequences? And serious consequences, criminal consequences. And I don't know what the answer is, but nothing strikes me as you getting off very easy and justice not being served. Now, initially, I want you to understand this, too. The county refused to even pay for the medical bills of this poor family. Again, I want you to put yourself in their shoes. You're minding your business. You never sold drugs. But somebody tells somebody who tells them that, hey, maybe they're selling amphetamine. So they bust in your door, no-knock raid, and nearly kill your baby. How would you feel? What would you do? Do you think that you know, there should be some kind of justice here where there should be some kind of punishment? And there's not. It's amazing. It's amazing. And then they refuse to pay the medical bills. Now, somehow they were able to get a settlement, though, later on, after going through a process where they got $964,000, I'm not even sure if that covers all the medical bills. And in reality, in my opinion, they should not only get their medical bills paid for, obviously, but then also, you know, I'd say they should get some sort of compensation. If the state nearly kills your baby in this grossly negligent way where you're falsely accused of selling drugs when you weren't, and they almost kill your baby when they do their no-knock raid, oh, absolutely you should get something out of that, and there should be some kind of punishment. So understand how fucked up this system is that we have right now. And, I mean, in all seriousness, I disagree with this from the very premise. And the premise, of course, is that law enforcement should be able to bust down your door, use violent tactics, because they heard through the grapevine that somebody was selling drugs when they weren't. Because in my view, even if they were selling drugs, I don't care. Ooh, I know, radical. Radical of me to say that and have that opinion, but what, not radical to blow a hole in the chest of this poor family's baby when they weren't doing anything wrong at all? No, you know who the real radicals are? They are. You know what's really radical? The system as it exists right now, which gives law enforcement officials a green light to basically harass minority communities under the guise of, we're doing it because of the drug war, we're protecting society from these horrible substances sold by these horrible people. No, it was the same thing with prohibition. When you banned it, when you made it illegal, it got pushed underground, and the mafia became immensely powerful as a result of it. The reason why criminals are dealing with the substance, insofar as they are, is because you made it illegal and pushed it underground. So criminals, by definition, are going to be involved in the trade. So when there's a dispute, people are going to shoot each other as opposed to going to court to solve it. It happened with alcohol when alcohol was illegal, never mind all the bad batches and poor regulation where people died because they made the alcohol in bathtubs with shitty chemicals. But it happens now with drugs too. That's why the cartels are super powerful, because you made the drugs illegal. And you've, again, given a green light for law enforcement officials to harass anybody and everybody, and they mostly harass poor people and minorities, because you said, okay, those are the bad communities, those are the ones you need to police. So it is, justice is on your side, morality is on your side if you do no-knock raids because you hear that somebody may be selling amphetamine. It's such bullshit, man. Could you imagine some sort of law enforcement raid, no-knock aggressive violent raid into the house of the CEO of Budweiser, for example, the CEO of Jack Daniel's? You knock down the door to their multi-million dollar mansion and you throw a stun grenade on the chest of their kid, and then you blow a hole in the kid's chest. You think that guy would possibly get justice? You think that cop would be locked up in that scenario? And you don't even need to use the example of the CEO of Budweiser or Jack Daniel's. I mean, you could use Red Bull, Monster Energy, the pharmaceutical companies that sell Xanax or Percocet. No, of course, in that case, well, oh my God, why would you do that? That's his job, is to head a company that sells a substance that fucks people up and intoxicates them. But nobody thinks that there's a moral dimension to that and they're criminals. No. We just say, no, that makes sense because whatever, there's a market demand and they're filling it. It is what it is. It's the free market. But when it comes to certain drugs, oh my God, you could go in there and blow a hole in the kid's chest by throwing a stun grenade in there and then have no justice afterwards. No, I'm sick of it. I'm tired of it. We have to change the laws so that bullshit like this stops happening. All right. Now, I'm going to go ahead and do the story on foreign policy. I feel like every month something comes out that further solidifies what liberals had said all along regarding the war in Iraq. Just more vindication, vindication, vindication. Every month something comes out with more details on that. Reuters did some fantastic investigative reporting in their new article on ISIS in Iraq. They do some fact-finding and they figure out exactly who makes up the top ISIS ranks. They say, quote, "Of ISIS 23 portfolios, which are equivalent to ministries, former Saddam regime officers run three of the most crucial: security, military, and finance," according to Hisham al-Hashimi, an Iraqi analyst who has worked with the Iraqi government. Iraq's finance minister, Hoshyar Zebari, a Kurd who spent years opposing Saddam's regime, said the ex-Ba'athists working with the Islamic State provide the group with highly effective guidance on explosives, strategy, planning. Quote, "They know who is who, family by family, name by name," he said. "In many ways, it is a union of convenience. Most former Ba'athist officers have little in common with ISIS. Saddam promoted Arab nationalism and secularism for most of his rule. But many of the ex-Ba'athists working with ISIS are driven by self-preservation and a shared hatred of the Shiite-led government in Baghdad. Others are true believers who became radicalized in the early years after Saddam's ouster, converted on the battlefield or in U.S. military and Iraqi prisons." One former intelligence commander who served in Iraq's National Intelligence Service from 2003 to 2009 said some ex-Ba'athists pushed out of state agencies by Iraq's government were only too happy to find new masters. Why, they say, quote, "ISIS pays them." Okay. This is an incredible piece. I urge you to read the entire thing because they really get into the nuance and the detail of exactly what happened after the invasion and what led to the rise of ISIS and becoming the powerhouse that they are today in certain regions in Iraq and in Syria. But the heart of what they're saying is very clear. In its current form, ISIS would not exist if it wasn't for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, toppling of Saddam, and more importantly, de-Ba'athifying the government, which, in other words, is getting rid of all of Saddam's party members from their positions of power. Because when you did that, what happened? You pissed off the entire Ba'athist community, moreover, the entire Sunni community in Iraq. Eventually, Maliki, who's a Shiite leader, took power. They flipped the repression against the Sunnis, further radicalizing the Sunnis, disenfranchising the Sunnis, and you made it so that a lot of them didn't want to, but they did a marriage of convenience with other Sunni religious extremists because they're trying to work with them so that the Sunnis get back in power and stop the Shiite-led oppression against them. So, look, the facts show, and this is the important part, guys, it's not just an opinion. It's pointing out historical facts that show that if we didn't get involved, if we didn't destabilize the region, if we didn't get rid of Saddam, if we didn't get rid of the Ba'athists in the government, there's no way that they would exist in the form that they do today, ISIS. So, and they're telling you, hey, in these very important areas, they're the leaders, explosives, strategy, and planning. And when they say something like strategy, what they're talking about is territorial gains. We learned that one of Saddam's right-hand men, for example, was a leader in Saddam's Ba'ath Party, and then he ended up teaming up with ISIS. He wrote in his personal diaries how, look, I'm not with these guys. I don't believe in their ideology. They're way too religious. They're way too fundamentalist. I'm using them to try to get more territory and more success and get back into power to, you know, knock off the Shias, essentially. So the religious fundamentalists on their own would not be able to get all this territorial success. Why? Because they don't know what the fuck they're doing. They have no strategy. They have no prior experience in that. They spent their entire life being brainwashed, reading the worst verses of the Quran and believing it literally. And they think God's on our side. He'll let us win everything, even if we don't know anything. Meanwhile, the Ba'athists are face-palming in the corner like, oh, no, you jackass. It's harder than you think. We're the only ones who know what we're doing, how to hold territory, how to govern once we get power and control. And they're the ones who are doing all the heavy lifting in order to, you know, make it so that the Sunnis come to power again as opposed to the Shiites when Maliki was in charge and leading in under his rule in Iraq. So it's straightforward. It's right there for you. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm blaming or any other liberal is blaming. Maybe Alex Jones and a few people are literally blaming the U.S. for the ideology of Salafism, which is this fundamentalist, literalist interpretation of Islam, which is the most conservative and the worst of all of them. That predates U.S. imperialism by quite a bit. Okay, so nobody's blaming them for the ideology. What we're saying is, hey, you jackasses, your poor strategy made that ideology more popular because of stuff like this, where your fuck-ups made an allegiance or an alliance of convenience between the people who know what they're doing militarily and the religious jack-offs. So if we didn't do that, that wouldn't be the case today. It would look a lot different. And Reuters did a fantastic job laying out in detail exactly why that is. So moving forward, what's the answer? Don't make the same mistakes. We're having a conversation today about toppling Assad in Syria. Now, this is not to say Assad's a good guy and, you know, we should give him a puppy and sing kumbaya with him. Of course not. But if you get rid of him, would you further destabilize the region? And is it likely that ISIS and al-Nusra, who are two of the biggest rebel factions, that they'll fill the power vacuum because they're the most determined? Yes! Yes! Assad, for all of his flaws, he's a Shia Alawite Ba'athist. So it's the same thing. It's a secular socialist constitution in Syria. Now, we're only against him because he happens to be aligned with Russia and Iran, and of course we're against them too. But so in other words, we're choosing the wrong side for the same reasons that we did in Iraq. Because we want more power, we want more control, we want more geopolitical strength, we want more allies in the region, and we're willing to accept a Salafi state in Syria so long as that Salafi state is willing to work with us business-wise, like Saudi Arabia, for example. So, but that's the thing, we're making the same mistakes today. Why are we dumping billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, on the lap of Saudi Arabia, who spreads this Salafist ideology by building mosques all over the place that preach this strain of Islam? The best way for us to stop the spread of radical Islam is to break off our relationship with Saudi Arabia, stop giving them all this money to finance this ideology, and to not side with Islamists and jihadists in other fights. So we shouldn't try to arm and give aid to the rebels in Syria, who many of them at this point are Islamists and jihadists. We should stop making the same mistakes over and over. We've learned that when we get involved and when we topple leaders throughout the Middle East, it never works out for the better, nor, by the way, do I think we have the right to fight anybody if it's not in self-defense, if there's no direct threat of attack against the U.S. So there's a principled objection to getting involved in the Middle East in this way, and then there's the further reason of it doesn't fucking work, and we fucked up repeatedly, and we've created worse problems. And this article in Reuters points that out perfectly. If it wasn't for our fuck-ups, you wouldn't have the immensely powerful ISIS that you have today. Okay. Now, there's one more thing I wanted to say about that, but I can't remember what it is, so I'm going to have to suck it up and move along. Yeah, that's it. I think the article kind of said it all anyway, and I was just going to elaborate on it, but you got the gist of it. Okay. So now we move on to some religion stuff. I got a bunch of religion stuff today. So mocking galore is what we'll be doing. Let's kick it off with that pew poll that I briefly mentioned at the top of the show. Pew Research did a fantastic new poll where they asked Americans how certain they are that God exists. So let's go through some of the numbers here, and then I'll break it down for you. Overall, 89% of the American people believe in God. Now, that actually requires a little further explanation because we've spoken about on the show before how I think it's 21% or 23% of the American people are now in the nuns category, N-O-N-E-S. And basically what that means is unaffiliated. Some of the nuns, the unaffiliated, still believe in God, but they're not part of any particular organized religion. So that's an important caveat to keep in mind, because at face value, people read that number, 89% believe in God, and they think that contradicts the other fact that we discussed, which is about 20% of people are in the nuns category. There's no contradiction, because some of the nuns believe in God or some sort of universal force or something like that, and it just means they're not affiliated with any organized religion. So right off the bat here, there's one caveat. But continuing, they say, what percentage is absolutely certain that God exists? Absolutely certain. That's their wording. You ready for this? 63% of the American people are absolutely certain God exists. That's incredible to me. That's absolutely incredible. Now, let me give you more specifics here per group. 76% of Christians, the broad category of Christians, are absolutely certain. 81% of Protestants are absolutely certain. I think it's 88% of evangelical Christians. 64% of Catholics are absolutely certain. And by the way, you could see kind of a dichotomy and a breakdown here of how conservative a religious group is, or more liberal or moderate a religious group is, based on their answer to this. So, evangelicals far more conservative on average than Catholics. So that means that, and you can see that, 88% of evangelicals are like, I'm absolutely certain God exists, whereas it's 64% of Catholics, so a little lower. 76% of Mormons believe God absolutely exists. 90% of Jehovah's Witnesses, good googly moogly, that's amazing. Now, Jews, only 37% are absolutely certain God exists. That's fucking awesome. It's true. There are just more, at least in the U.S. I don't know the numbers for the rest of the world, but at least in the U.S., there are many what you'd call cultural Jews who say, yeah, I'm Jewish in the sense that I was born into a Jewish family, but am I certain God exists? No. So they're the best category so far. Let's continue here. Hindu, 41%. Muslims, 84%. So they're the opposite extreme, even in the U.S., where 84% are absolutely certain, they say, that God exists. And you ready for this? Screw by a mile. Buddhists, only 29% certain. That's awesome. So there's your overall breakdown per group. But let's go back for a second to that main number. 63% of the American people say they are absolutely certain God exists. So they know. That's what they're saying. We know God exists. Allow me to respond by saying this. No, you don't. Every single one of you, every single one of the 63%, I'm respecting you enough to look you in the eyes right now, see, and say, no, you don't. You might think you do, but you don't. Because anybody who's honest with themselves on the question of do you know, we're all agnostic. We'd all say, I don't know. And it's important to make a distinction here because there's two categories, what you know versus what you believe. So I, for example, I'm an atheist. So I don't actively believe in a God and live my life as if there's a God. So in that sense, I'm clearly an atheist. But in the no sense, so to answer the what do you know question as opposed to the what do you believe question, when it comes to no, I don't know, which is why I say I'm an agnostic. So there are plenty of people, and if you talk to atheists in my experience, though this is anecdotal, most atheists are agnostic atheists. So we're very honest and very straightforward about how in the no department, we don't know. Richard Dawkins, who's like the poster boy of people would say atheist arrogance and certitude. He even says on a scale, I forget his exact numbers, but on a scale, he's not 100%. He doesn't know that there's no God. He believes there's no God, but in terms of knowing, no, he's agnostic. Like I'd say most atheists are agnostic on that. So it's hilarious that atheists are tarred with this thing that they're arrogant. They're the ones who have too much certitude and they look down and they're condescending to everybody else. No, we're the ones who say, we don't know, bro. I don't know. I'll tell you what I believe, but I don't know. That's honesty. Whereas 63% of Americans, 63 say they are absolutely certain God exists. They know that God exists. How can you know if there's no way to know? So 63% of the American people, let's say for a second that was true. That would mean that 63% of people literally had God come down and talk to them and prove to them that he is indeed real. He, she, it, whatever the fuck you want to call it, is real. And they were like, sold. But then you bring up that age-old problem, man. You talk to God, you're religious. God talks to you, you're a psychopath. You know, you're paranoid schizophrenic. You need whatever it is, Thorazine, Seroquel, antipsychotic drugs, a straitjacket. So, okay, if I'm to believe 63% of the American people, 63% know that God exists, you guys should all be put in fucking nutty houses. You know God exists, but you don't know God exists. How do you know? You don't know. You want to know how I know you don't know? Because I don't know. And, you know, I'm relatively confident that none of you are fucking Superman or Batman and have powers that other people don't have. Throughout history, anybody who claims to have had that has been a charlatan, a liar, or a fucking magician. A magician who does it. Woo, Chris Angel, I did a trick. Ooh, are you convinced I have special powers? Oh, I have special powers. To be fair to Chris Angel, he doesn't say he has special powers, neither does David Blaine. But I was talking about this the other day. People are so gullible, perhaps they can make a case. You know, if David Blaine existed at the same time as Jesus, you really think we would all take Jesus's word and people would be Christians today? No, I think more people would be part of Blainianity, and they would think that he was the one true God, because you should have saw the shit that he did, man. The shit that he did was incredible. I saw him do things that you can't explain but for the fact that he's the Son of God, and they would believe in that. Guys, 63% of the American people out to lunch on this, out to lunch on this. And look, got to get hard on the same percentage in every group. So in this case, in America, yeah, you can say Muslims, 84%, you guys are the worst on this issue. 84% of you know that God exists, but that's not true. You don't know. Nobody knows. At least if you're going to be religious, at least be intellectually honest and say, I believe in my religion. I believe in it, but I don't know because I'm not a child. I don't have to pump myself up by saying Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Harry Potter, or any other Dr. Seuss or any other nonsense fairy tale is true. At least be intellectually honest. 63% of the American people are not intellectually honest. They're lying to the pollsters, and more importantly, they're lying to themselves. I literally broke my pen at the conclusion of that rant. That was hilarious. Okay. I got to take a break. When we come back, I will go on to mock creationists. I will do it. So you stay right there. You wait for it. It's coming. And then later, we will get into... A Catholic priest in New York who, goddamn, man, he is they should put him on posters, or they should put him by the word hypocrisy in the dictionary, because he really embodies every aspect of it. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
I'm wearing right now my shiny-ass jacket. That's what I call it, my shiny-ass jacket. I think it really looks like I jumped in the water. I jumped in the ocean and killed a shark and then literally wore the shark skin. That's what it looks like. I mean, it's a shark skin suit. It's not made of actual shark skin, but it looks like it is because it's actually kind of like the shade of a shark. Maybe a touch darker. But I don't know how I feel about it. I used to like it, but now I'm, I don't know. I'll wait for all the feedback. All right, let's go after these goofy fucking creationists. Televangelist Brad Shockley did an awesome segment on Let the Bible Speak TV, which I'm sure is very educational. So let's look at his intellectual defense of creationism.
People are fascinated with dinosaurs. Mm. From a very young age, we are amazed by these magnificent creatures. People are in awe of these awesome reptiles, and questions abound. Where did these massive creatures come from? If they were in existence in the past, why is the Bible silent about them?
Mm.
Can I believe in the Bible and accept the existence of dinosaurs as a fact? Creation is rarely credited and often attacked in the media. How sad that society proclaims the need for open-mindedness, yet pulls down the curtain on creation while promoting evolution. One who holds the creation worldview is in the minority, and we often have a difficult time convincing others this is the proper explanation. The creationist accepts the teaching of Genesis and teaches dinosaurs were created on day 5, the day sea-dwelling and flying creatures were created, and day 6, the day land animals were created, according to Genesis chapter 1, verses 20 through 25. Humanity was created by God on day 6, according to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 27, and shared this world with the dinosaurs. All of these events took place approximately 6,000 years ago. If you read the Bible from cover to cover, you will not find the word dinosaur. However, just because you can't find the term dinosaur in the Bible, you shouldn't make the mistake of thinking the Bible has nothing to say about dinosaurs. The explanation is rather simple. The word dinosaur did not come into existence until the year 1842. That is over 200 years after the King James English translation of the Bible. Even though we will not find the word dinosaur in Scripture, we can find several passages describing creatures that clearly fit our understanding of dinosaurs. In the book of Job, we read a behemoth. The Bible mentions a massive creature so large that by all accounts, the only plausible explanation is that we are reading about a dinosaur. Most study Bibles state in the notes, behemoth is most likely an elephant. That is a colossal mistake. The text is very clear. Behemoth is much larger than an elephant. You see, the truth is, dinosaurs should be used as the poster child for creationism. And we have no problem harmonizing our faith with the Bible explanation of dinosaurs.
Oh, that was adorable. That was so adorable. My favorite is at the end of the speech, he gives that face like he absolutely nailed it, just like George W. Bush used to do after he didn't make any sense and contradicted himself and used words that don't fit in context. And he's like, he really was proud of himself after that. So he starts out by saying, well, you know, dinosaurs are not mentioned in the Bible, so maybe this is a little bit of a problem for creationists, but let me explain why it's not. And then by the end of it, he's like, so dinosaurs are a perfect example of why creationism is true. It's like watching a third grader try to make sense of the world. So let's get a few basic facts out there right now. He keeps saying, well, you know, it has to fit in a 6,000-year time frame. Why? Because that's how old the world is according to the Bible. If you count up the stories and go back, how fucking scientific. Well, dinosaurs, in reality, they weren't around, you know, 5,800 years ago or whatever time frame this guy thinks they would have existed. They died out 65 million years ago. Kind of a relevant fact. Kind of relevant. He's like, no, 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 forget that. They existed, but they were around like 5,800 years ago. Well, then why is it that not a single scientist on the planet says they were around here then? And then he was, they're testing our faith. They're testing our faith or something like that. Hey, guy, we actually have radiocarbon dating, for example, and other scientific dating methods where we can figure out exactly how old certain things are within a very specific range, a fairly specific range. So we know, for example, that the world is 4.54 billion years old. You missed the mark by a little bit, didn't you, when you say it's only 6,000 years old? The universe, we know, is about 13.9 billion years old. How does he explain all this away? He's like, yeah, science, testing our faith again. We know the Bible's to believe over science. Okay, well then let's dig a little deeper on that one, shall we? You do know that there are multiple parts of the Bible where they allude to the earth being flat, where they say, for example, that people sailed to the four corners of the earth. The earth doesn't have corners. What would have corners? A flat earth, right? Certain shapes of a flat earth. But it's in there multiple times. So, you know, you say Bible's to be believed over the scientists. Okay, do you believe the earth is flat? But see, I ask that and pose it as if it's a gotcha, because to actual intelligent people, it is a gotcha. But in his mind, he might just be like, yes. Yes, indeed, the world is flat. And then at the beginning, this is one of my favorite lines. He says, society demands open-mindedness, but then it rips creationism. As if that's like a contradiction. As if open-mindedness therefore means we have to entertain things that are absolutely, positively, objectively, factually, empirically wrong. No, we could still say, you're wrong, and believe in open-mindedness, in the same way that we could say, no, 2 plus 2 does not equal 22, and still be open-minded. You can reject things which are not true and still believe in open-mindedness. That doesn't mean you have to accept false answers to believe in open-mindedness. And he goes on to say, at other parts of the clip, that the Bible has references to behemoths in there and dragons. Therefore, those were dinosaurs. End of conversation. So creationism is true because they alluded to dinosaurs, and we can account for dinosaurs existing and being around at the same time as people. His logic makes less than no sense, if that's possible. I like how he just asserts behemoth is obviously significantly bigger than an elephant. But you just said that. Just because you said it doesn't mean it's true. Behemoth is bigger. Why? Because I say so. That's my opinion, but I'm going to state it as if it's a fact. And like what? All the dunces listening along are going to be like, yeah, that's right. No, that's true. Behemoth is technically only about 29 feet and bigger. And an elephant, you know, they only get up to like 25 feet. So he's right. Behemoth is technically bigger than an elephant. No, it's not. What are you saying? What are you saying? And he uses the dragons in the Bible as those are the dinosaurs. That's what it is. I know. I found them. Dragons are in the Bible. What else? What does he not tell you about the dragons that are mentioned in the Bible? Just to give one example, and we've referenced this on the show before, there's a red seven-headed dragon in one of the parts of the Bible. It's weird that he left that part out, right? Like, you know, you were all, oh, no, those are the dinosaurs, see, rah-rah. But then you don't say, well, one of them was seven-headed. Do we have evidence of seven-headed dragons that have existed, you know, throughout time? No, we don't, because those are made up, just like the rest of the Bible. You look like a child trying to get to the answer that you like the most, as opposed to being objective and letting the facts take you in whatever direction they do take you. Okay. More. Carolyn Walker Diallo is a municipal judge in New York. She's a black woman, and she's a Muslim as well. And she recently took her oath and was sworn in as a municipal judge, and she swore in on the Quran. And naturally, there was a massive backlash. The website Young Cons said the following, quote, "I'd much rather have a judge swear on the Bible than on the Quran, because one doesn't call for the deaths of infidels. Can you guess which? America isn't a Christian nation? Why then do 70%+ of U.S. citizens identify as Christian? Does the phrase founded on Judeo-Christian principles ring any bells?" I love it when people are arrogant and smug, but they're wrong. Because there's something that's so gratifying about that, because it's unearned condescension. Like, it's one thing if somebody's being condescending and they're just right, but if they're being condescending and they're just totally wrong, it's like, oh, man, what? Oh, this smells weird. What's happening here? So, needless to say, no, the U.S. is not a Christian nation. The Founding Fathers were very clear that, indeed, we are a secular nation. In fact, it was Thomas Jefferson in one of his letters wrote that there is a wall of separation between church and state in the United States of America. You have other founding fathers who said, we are in no way, quote, no way founded on the Christian religion. And then you also have the fucking Constitution itself. How many times does the Constitution reference Christianity? Zero. How about Jesus? How about the Bible? Zero. The only time it references religion is to say the state cannot establish one. There can be no religious test for office. So you're just wrong on that. The only thing you're right about is that over 70% of the U.S. population are Christians, but that doesn't mean it's a Christian nation. It just means that over 70% of the U.S. population are Christians. And to the point that, well, you know, the Quran, because that's a violent book, but the Bible, not violent at all. Okay, so let's look at one verse for that. Deuteronomy 13, line 6 to 10, calls for killing people who are not Christian. So not only are you're wrong about the specifics, where he says, you know, in the Bible it doesn't say we should kill, you know, all infidels. Now, in the Islamic context, that means people who don't believe in Islam. In the Christian context, it means people who don't believe in Christianity. And in Deuteronomy 13, line 6 to 10, that's exactly what they say. All right, so either way, putting all this aside, I'm willing to make a compromise with these jack-off conservatives. I will shake on it right now. People cannot swear in on the Quran if people also cannot swear in on the Bible. You want to make that deal? Now, I actually don't think they'd even make that deal, because their love of Christianity overrides their dislike of the Quran. So when an atheist like myself steps in and says, hey, let's do what we really should be doing, at least if we believed in any rational interpretation of the Constitution, and let's get rid of all of the swearing in for government positions on holy books. It's a government job, and you're swearing on a holy book with all types of myths. And that's, I'm really going to be serious about this. I'm fucking swearing on a book that says the earth is flat. It's stupid. It's stupid, and it's outdated, and it's dumb. So, yeah, I'm for, can't swear in on the Quran. Sorry. Can't swear in on any holy book. No Bible, no Quran, no Bhagavad Gita, no bullshit in your mama's ass. I don't care. None of it. Get rid of all the holy books. Let's swear in on the Constitution, like fucking Americans would. How about that? But they wouldn't take that deal. I guarantee you. All right, next. Let's talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia. We got some kind of good news coming out of there, believe it or not. At least 14 women won municipal council seats in Saudi Arabia's first ever election open to female voters and candidates. The AFP explains, quote, but with 2,106 seats up for election, the 14 women will constitute less than 1% of Saudi Arabia's elected council membership. More than 900 women were among the 6,440 candidates standing for seats on 284 councils. They say they had to overcome a number of obstacles to participate. Female candidates could not meet face-to-face with male voters during the campaigning, while neither men nor women could publish their pictures. Women voters said registration was hindered by factors including bureaucratic obstacles and a lack of transportation. As a result, women accounted for less than 10% of registered voters. According to Election Commission data, nearly 1.5 million people aged 18 and above signed up for the polls. This included about 119,000 women out of a total native Saudi population of almost 21 million. The duties of municipal councils are limited to local affairs that include streets, public gardens, and garbage collection. So Saudi Arabia, as all of you guys know at this point, it's a theocratic monarchy. It's a Sharia state, and it's effectively, keep it real, it's a dictatorship. It's the royal family. Oh, we get to control everything. Dictatorship. Okay, so the elections are minimal. They're for very, very local issues, limited things here, but they do have elections for these limited things. This was the first time that women were allowed on the ballot, which makes them literally the last country to allow women on the ballot. That's amazing. Every other country has women on the ballot before Saudi Arabia. So that's good news coming out of Saudi, but everything in perspective here, women still can't go anywhere without a chaperone. According to The Week, they can't drive a car, wear clothes or makeup that, quote, show off their beauty. They have to limit their interactions with men. They can't swim. They can't compete freely in sports. They can't try on clothes when shopping, enter a cemetery, read an uncensored fashion magazine, or buy a Barbie. And the list goes on and on here. So, I mean, needless to say, it's good that they finally took the obvious step of allowing women to vote. Some of them a little bit, even though they face great suppression of their vote. It's good that they're on the ballot, some of them, even though, again, there were hurdles and hurdles and hurdles to get over. And it's good that some of them won. But the reality is we shouldn't just hold them to a lower bar because they're Saudi and you know, we're used to them having the low bar. We should hold them to a higher bar or the same bar as everybody else. And that would mean stop with the Salafi nonsense. Stop with the literal interpretation of Islam and forcing everybody to live under that rule. And yes, move towards human rights like the rest of the world. But, oh, I should watch what I'm saying here because what do I know about human rights? It's not like I lead the Human Rights Council in the UN or anything like that. You know who does, right? Saudi Arabia. That's totally fucked up. They shouldn't be leading that council. But right, this is an example of Saudi Arabia moving an inch closer to justice and human rights and civility, okay? But they moved an inch on what is the equivalent of something the size of a football field. They got a long way to go before they get to the right place. But 14 women elected there, it's a start. Now let's keep building on that. Running out of time, but I gotta get more of this stuff in because there's a lot of stuff to talk about. Fuck, I got three more things to get to. Definitely not getting all of those in. News 12, Mediaite, and the New York Post and a bunch of other outlets. Blah, blah, blah. Let me try that again. News 12 and the New York Post and Mediaite, among some other outlets, are reporting that a Catholic priest in the Bronx allegedly stole over $1 million from two different churches and used the money for male prostitutes. They say, quote, Reverend Peter McKelly stole donations from a church in Throgs Neck and St. Francis Cabrini Church on Roosevelt Island and used the money not just for the prostitute, but for renovations on his home. McKelly paid the prostitute $1,000 a session to act out his sexual fantasies, and apparently part of that involved BDSM slave and slave master role-playing. He also allegedly paid tens of thousands of dollars for illegal drugs, bought an apartment for the prostitute, who's identified as Keith Christ, and took trips to Florida and Italy, all with the money that he stole. So the priest's ex-girlfriend goes on to give some details here. She wrote to Cardinal Dolan in New York and said this, quote, "Keith Christ, the male prostitute, uses Father McKelly as his toilet, and Father McKelly drinks his piss during their weekly three-day get-togethers." So naturally, since the Catholic Church, I mean, they're a holy institution that cares about God and believes in God. Naturally, when they heard this, they were mortified because, sin, you're sinning! So what did they do? Cardinal Dolan proceeded to do nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm so shocked. I thought that the institution, which turned a blind eye to mass child fucking, everybody was diddling and boinking little boys all over the place. It was systemic. And they were like, what? No, this is going on here. We're holy. What do you mean? What do you mean? I thought that that institution was going to, you know, have a moment where they say, I will stand up and call out the people who are against our values. And by the way, let me be crystal clear about something. Do I have a problem with dudes who like to hook up with dudes and they like to piss in each other's mouth? No. Go right ahead. In fact, if that makes you happy, I encourage it. Go ahead. Piss in people's mouths. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. But the problem here is they're fucking hypocrites. They judge everybody and anybody for any little thing that's immoral but not really immoral. Oh, my God, you're gay, immoral. Oh, my God, did an affair or cheated, whatever, immoral. Oh, my God, gay marriage, immoral. Oh, my God, polygamy, whatever. They judge everybody for everything. Meanwhile, they're like, oh, I love it when male hookers piss in my face and in my mouth. It's so great. Oh, I love it. I'm so hard right now. So you're fucking hypocrites. That's the problem. The problem is you say that this is immoral, that it's a horrible sin, and then you do it. At least be honest and say, actually, I kind of like it. Say it. Say it. Come out. Admit it. Be open. Be honest. That's what we're mad about, the hypocrisy and about you judging everybody for everything, when in reality, you know, deep down, is there really something wrong here? No, I'm doing it. I'm acting in this way. You know, if you think something is really immoral, you know what happens? You don't do it. I have a principled objection to killing people. The only time I'd ever kill somebody is in self-defense. But I've never been in the position where I had to kill somebody in self-defense, so I've never killed anybody. See, I really think killing is immoral, so I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. But these guys are like, oh, no, it says gay sex, all that stuff. Immoral, immoral, immoral. And they're like, blah, blah, gargling on cocks left and right. Piss in my face. Oh, yeah, piss in my mouth. I love it. It's so hot. You're hypocrites. That's the problem, man. So I would be like, cool, let it go. But you can't let it go because you're hypocrites, because you judge everybody else. And more importantly, you stole money from everybody. You know, that's the problem. You found a way to live in two extremes, where you're trying to pump up yourself and believe yourself that, oh, my God, I'm moral. I got to be moral. I got to be rigid, and I got to be strict in what my code is. And then behind the scenes, you go swing the pendulum in the other direction, and you act against the things that you say constitute morality. Well, no. Your actions matter. None of the sexual stuff is immoral. What's immoral is everything you did, the hypocrisy, the judging of others, and the stealing money. Okay, and finally, I only got time for one more here. Newsweek is reporting that schools in Philly have banned the book Huckleberry Finn because of the use of the N-word. They say, quote, "Academics remain divided on the issue. On one hand, the book, published shortly after the end of the Civil War, continues to shed light on America's shameful history of systemic racism and slavery, which will likely forever evoke feelings of discomfort. Yet the idea of changing the original language of Huckleberry Finn to some equates to revisionist history. In 2011, the Alabama-based publisher New South Books replaced the N-word with the word slave." Now, here's an interesting fact. They explain that when the book was released in 1885, it was also super controversial, and it was called, quote, "vulgar, inelegant, ungrammatical, coarse, irreverent, semi-obscene, trashy, and vicious," and they attacked it because it dared to depict an interracial friendship. At the time, they thought, oh my God, that's the most immoral thing ever. A black person and a white person are friends? Oh, obscene. Take that book off the shelf. That's why they were outraged over it. Fast forward to today, and you have people mad because they say, look, the N-word's in there, and that makes us uncomfortable. That's what the argument is. So where do I fall on this? I think they should keep the book in the curriculum, and I think they should leave it as is, because we have to stop pretending like context doesn't matter. So, for example, if a rapper uses the N-word and it's N-I-G-G in a song, I'm not judging that person. That rapper, they're using it in context in a song. They mean it in an endearing way. It's not derogatory. It's not negative in any way, shape, or form. And it is what it is. That's one context. Is that the same thing as an old white dude in Mississippi screaming N-I-G-G-E-R? At some young black kids? No, one of that one sucks, and you shouldn't use it in that context. That's wrong. It's fine, and it's okay to use it in the other context where the rapper uses it. It's the same thing here. To have the book, the word in context in a book, get over yourself. It's in context in a book, and it's from a different time, literally. So look through it, read the book, and look at it through that lens and through that prism and learn something, okay? Don't let your feelings always override stuff like this. You have to be smart about this. You have to be rational about this. And you can't have zero tolerance rules where that in every single circumstance you use the N-word and, oh, my God, it's the worst thing ever and we should totally ban it in every way, shape, and form. No, that doesn't make any sense. That's irrational, which is why I'm against this move. All right, guys, I'm out of time. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.